on corn and soybeans. We have also displaced the crop diversity that provides the necessary habitat for bees to survive. The loss of bees is not trivial because of their crucial role in producing food. Bees are said to be responsible for producing as much as one of every three bites of food that we eat. Corn and soybeans, the staples of American processed food, are self-pollinators. This means that they reproduce without depending on insects. Yet many of the fresh fruits, vegetables, and nuts that we eat, including apples, almonds, squash, and avocados, are largely dependent on bees. An apple can only be produced, for instance, when pollen grains from the male part of the flower of an apple tree are transferred to the female part of the flower. The apple flower generally cannot do this on its own. A honeybee may visit as many as 5,000 apple flowers a day, and bits of the female pollen get stuck to its body as it flies from flower to flower, creating the conditions in which an apple flower can pollinate and then fruit. Were bees to disappear, we would lose much of our ability to produce many of our healthiest foods. After a year, Sarah began to help in the harvest of honey. We were able to get as much as 100 pounds a year from each of our hives. We started selling bottles of urban honey alongside our worm castings. We were careful to leave enough for the bees to ensure the survival of their colony, and beekeeping became a part of our agricultural education program. Between February and March 2003, Growing Power hosted 4-weekend workshops called Grow Your Community Food System from the Ground Up. Our breakout sessions included beekeeping, community project design, taught by Erica, who came up from Chicago, vermiculture, aquaculture, composting, marketing, animal health, youth leadership, and the essentials of gardening. Erica was assuming many of the responsibilities that Hope Finkelstein once managed, including grant writing. Although Hope flew from Anchorage to Milwaukee faithfully for every workshop and remained as invested in the future of the organization as when she began, by the summer of 2003, it had become clear to both of us that maintaining our working relationship at such a long distance was too difficult. Hope was still handling much of the financial paperwork for the organization, and it was challenging for us to coordinate payments. It was also hard to explain to funders why a Milwaukee-based organization had an address based in Anchorage. Hope joined forces with me at a crucial time, and she played a large role in Growing Power's future. She gave me a name that precisely expressed our purpose. She helped me define my mission as a community food center. We parted on friendly but bittersweet terms. It was hard for me to let go of Growing Power, Hope told me recently. She took comfort, she said, that the work of an organization she fostered would continue. By the time Hope left, we had grown to have a staff of 7 people, with more than 100 volunteers. Hope saw food as a tool to bring folks from different walks of life together to the same table. Across town, 2 other children of the Great Migration were teaching me the power of gardens to rally a broken community. In 2001, I met Sharon and Larry Adams. Sharon's father had fled Tennessee decades earlier after he was arrested for possession of a knife. He had been caught peeling an apple on a street. He had long been resented in a primarily white community for being a black landowner. After his arrest, he decided he was done with Tennessee. He moved to Milwaukee in the mid-1950s with a Mayflower truck and enough money to buy a house, but he couldn't find a white homeowner who would sell to him. He was a victim of the widespread practice of redlining, when real estate agents and homeowners denied African-American migrants entry into white communities. Sharon's father eventually settled his family on Walnut Street, in a neighborhood of sturdy single-family homes that was then becoming the center of the city's African-American cultural life. Sharon remembers hearing her father speak fondly around the kitchen table of his land in Tennessee. They had horses, and all the food they could eat, and they could hunt on their land, Sharon said. I had this experience hearing about this wonderful environment that I wasn't privileged to, but I lived it because I heard their stories. On Walnut Street, neighbors offered support and housing to newcomers from the Great Migration. Segregation forced us to be self-sufficient and to rely on each other, Sharon said. By the late 1990s, however, Sharon's former neighborhood was rife with gang activity. Gunshots were frequently heard at night. Prostitutes walked the block. Many of the homes in the community had been demolished. This decline began in the wake of President Eisenhower's Federal Aid Highway Act of 1956, which led to the demolition of homes and businesses across 83 acres of the community to make way for a proposed Park West Freeway. More than a dozen black-owned businesses were shuttered and destroyed, even though the freeway was ultimately never built. The neighborhood fell apart. Returning to Milwaukee from New York in the 1990s, Sharon hoped to play a part in repairing the broken fabric of her former community. The decaying Victorian house that she and her husband bought on 17th Street and North Avenue in 1997 was slated to be razed by the city, one of several abandoned homes marked for demolition in Lindsay Heights. Soon after moving to the neighborhood, Sharon knocked on doors and gathered the remaining longtime residents for a planning and brainstorming session. She wanted to talk about how to rescue their community. She organized group walks as a show of force to signal that residents were taking their streets back. Larry and Sharon also started a nonprofit organization called Walnut Way Conservation Corporation, committed to the purpose of transforming the 110 blocks that made up Lindsay Heights. Sharon had heard of my work, and she asked me to visit the neighborhood. Larry walked me through the community for the first time in 2001, and he spoke of his vision of restoring the homes and healing the land there. I respected Larry's optimism, but most of the homes looked abandoned and in disrepair. A few young men with do-rags and tank tops walked the streets. They appeared to be up to no good. It felt unsafe even in daytime and more dangerous than my neighborhood along Silver Spring Drive. "I'm not sure, man," Larry remembers me saying. "This is kind of crazy." I still said that I was willing to help. Larry and Sharon and their neighbors soon planted tulips and raised flower beds in empty lots. I brought some of my compost and helped them plant a community vegetable garden in a lot outside of Sharon and Larry's home. In October of 2001, soon after the tragedy of September 11th, Sharon and Larry hosted a harvest festival there, the first community block party in the neighborhood in 20 years. By 2002, I was frequently hauling worms and compost to help Walnut Way. I assisted several residents as they built their own backyard vegetable gardens. Sharon and Larry helped set up rainwater collection systems that could irrigate them. Sharon worked independently of me to bring more trees and flowers to the community. One older resident told Sharon that as a child in the South, she loved eating fresh peaches. Sharon thought peaches couldn't grow in a northern climate until she visited the backyard of another neighbor. "I had never seen a peach tree, and she had a beautiful one," Sharon said. She told me a story. Her grandmother had taught her to take a peach pit, put it in the freezer for a while, take it out, and to dig a small hole in the ground. She learned how to place the pit in the ground and to put a small mason jar upside down over the top of it to create a small hothouse. After you left the pit alone, when the tree had taken firm root, you could remove the mason jar. Larry tried this technique, and it worked. He soon had cultivated a Milwaukee peach orchard. In years to come, the community garden on 17th and North Avenue grew peaches, lettuces, collards, and kale. Some of it was sold at the Fondy Farmers Market, which was located on the northwest corner of the neighborhood. Walnut Way was also able to start its own urban agriculture intern program for young people in the community. The greening of the Lindsay Heights neighborhood helped set the stage for other forms of reinvestment. Walnut Way secured forgivable loans to build and rehabilitate homes. More than 60 subsidized houses have since been built in the neighborhood. Several existing homes have been restored, and crime has declined significantly. A number of small businesses have opened, including a new coffee shop called Coffee Makes You Black. Sharon and Larry and members of Walnut Way also engaged in a fight in 2008 to prevent the opening of a fried chicken restaurant, Church's Chicken, in the neighborhood. If opened, the store would have been the third fried chicken restaurant in 10 blocks along a stretch of North Avenue. Sharon spoke against the restaurant at zoning board meetings, organized a community vigil, and explained her reasoning to an often skeptical press. "Anytime you live in an area where you don't have healthy choices, you don't have a healthy community," Sharon told a local reporter. Walnut Way's opposition drew sharp criticism. Patrick McIllerin, a columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, called the organization's activities anti-investment. He argued that Walnut Way's opposition could scare away investors from greater Milwaukee. One of his columns suggested that Sharon needed therapy. Sharon knew she was not anti-investment. She felt that if a neighborhood was a fast food alley, as she called it, it scared away other kinds of businesses. People found it harder to make good food choices, even if they wanted to. Sharon wished to create a food environment where the healthy choice was the easy choice. The debate over the proposed Church's Chicken spread through the neighborhood, including at a community center near the Fondy Farmers Market. Children in an after-school program at the center discussed whether they wanted to be part of Walnut Way's vigil to oppose the restaurant. 16 of the kids attended the vigil, holding signs with slogans such as, "No more chicken. We want healthy choices." More than two-thirds of the children in the after-school program, however, chose not to attend. Many of them said they liked fried chicken and that they thought the store would bring jobs. Church's Chicken ultimately decided not to move into the neighborhood. Sharon and Larry want to bring healthier restaurants to the community, and they are expanding the offerings at the existing farmers' markets there. Larry has become a beekeeper at the community garden adjacent to his house. The peach blossoms give his honey a memorable taste. Walnut Way's urban honey has become so popular that the Adamses must limit the number of bottles that each customer is allowed to order each year. Sharon believes that the changes in Lindsay Heights began when the community started to heal the land. Large challenges remain. 4 in 10 of the residents in the neighborhood live in poverty, and nearly half do not have a high school diploma. They are still not enough grocers offering fresh food and no restaurants that serve healthy, affordable fare. Yet the trajectory of the community's future is different. Sharon is convinced that African Americans who have been divorced from their history can feel a little more whole when they put their hands in the soil and grow food. By doing this work, we are giving respect to both the joys and struggles of our ancestors, Sharon says. For anyone who works to improve communities, the process of improving people's lives can be painfully slow, much like the processes of nature. Sharon and Larry have kept at their work for 15 years now, and their impact is still unfolding. After a decade on Silver Spring Drive, I also felt that my own impact was hard to measure. Deshaun began his senior year of high school in 2004. He had felt many pressures building inside of him. At his school, he had let some people know his sexual orientation. If there was a gay role in a play for acting class, Deshaun volunteered to take it. Several of the people whom he thought were friends suddenly didn't want anything to do with him anymore. Small things made him sad or angry. I got to the point where if I would see a couple holding hands, or if I saw a romantic movie, I would hurt, he said, because I knew that wasn't me. That wasn't what I could have. He kept things inside him for a very long time, says his sister, Deshelle. If you knew him, you knew how he was feeling based on his body. If he was slumped, if his shoulders were squared off, if he was trying to seek attention, you could tell by those things that was going on inside of him. But he wasn't able to express himself. Soon after his senior year began, Deshaun was sitting in English class when suddenly, for reasons he didn't understand, the weight of what he had held within himself began to pour out of him. He began crying from the back of the classroom, and he couldn't stop. He felt like a river that had tripped the dam. His classmates, who were usually a rowdy bunch, grew silent. His teacher did not know what to do. Deshaun didn't have his phone on him, and he asked the person sitting next to him if he could borrow hers. He got Deshaun on the line, and he said, "I can't do this. I don't want to do this." He meant his life. "I'm on my way right now," Deshaun said. Deshaun's English teacher escorted him to the office on the lower level of the school. Within a few minutes, Deshaun was there, and she held her brother in her arms. She soon took him to the small house where she was living while pursuing her master's degree in social work. Deshaun later reflected on the strength his sister gave him that day by showing her own vulnerability. "I always thought that my sister had her stuff together," Deshaun says. "She was always on the honor roll. She was always 4 point. I was always 2 point. I was never up to her level. Yet that day, she told me every negative thing that she had ever done. It showed me that me and her were still the same. And I fell in love with my sister even more. During his senior year, Deshaun began to channel more of his energy into the kitchen. For a long time, his mother, Karen, had been in charge of cooking food for the lunches and dinners of our training workshops. Deshaun always helped her. When our workshops began to grow larger and more frequent, Karen gave Deshaun more responsibility. Deshaun asked to create his own items, including Asian and Mexican dishes that he read about in cookbooks. He created delicious Italian dishes, such as a lasagna with pesto, adding herbs that he grew and picked in our back greenhouses. Though he did not have full use of his hands since the fire, he was able to grip enough of the utensils to do whatever he needed on his own. I could sense the pride in him when people told him his food was delicious, although he was often too shy to respond. Deshaun began quietly to entertain the idea of becoming a chef. In the spring of 2005, Lulu knew that Deshaun's prom was coming up, and she started teasing him about it. "So, who are you taking?" she said. Deshaun thought about it a little bit, and he decided to ask Lulu. She gratefully accepted. On the afternoon of the prom, Karen and Deshaun paid for Lulu to go to a salon and get curls put in her hair. Earlier in the week, they also went shopping with Lulu to buy her prom dress. Karen hired a limousine to pick Lulu and Deshaun up from the house at Silver Spring Drive. "I had never had anything like that," Lulu says. That was special. As growing power evolved, it had become a family. We quarreled sometimes, and things weren't perfect. But I took pride that the family on West Silver Spring Drive was one of many races and backgrounds. Milwaukee was recently ranked as the most segregated city in the country. But on our small piece of earth, we struggled and celebrated together, black and white, Hispanic and Hmong, young and old, as we worked to produce healthy food. Will's Compost. As I travel the country to look at new urban agriculture projects, I can predict a group's future success by how much attention has been paid to creating fertile soil. It's all about the soil, I say. It's very difficult to plant directly into city land and expect good results. In many industrial locations, the soil is not only infertile, but it is also contaminated with heavy metals and lead. One of the benefits of growing food in an urban setting, though, is that there is a vast amount of food and paper waste nearby that can be repurposed into growing soil and healthy food. It just needs to be redirected before it gets to the landfill. At my urban farm on Silver Spring Drive, we can grow so intensively because we plant directly in compost. A lot of our compost is created in static piles. We set up the compost bins and let nature do the work, rather than turning it over from time to time. Static piles take longer to break down, as much as 2 years instead of 3 months, but they're also less labor-intensive. In an urban neighborhood, a static pile can reduce the release of smells that are unpleasant for your neighbors. We rely upon materials that are in broad supply in Milwaukee, such as beer mash, soggy grains that are left over from the brewing process. But for the most part, our raw materials are available in any community. Here's how your community organization can create your own compost using my methods. I recommend building an entire compost bin all at once, rather than incrementally. This will require collaboration with businesses in your community in order to obtain the large amount of raw materials you'll need. The process of obtaining sources of nitrogen and carbon can build relationships that will serve you well if you scale up your composting operation later. Supplies. 1. A compost bin. You can build your own from discarded lumber, wooden shipping pallets, and wire mesh. Step-by-step building plans can be found online. Our bins are 4 feet high, 4 feet wide, and 4 feet long. Roughly 20 wheelbarrows of organic material high in nitrogen. Examples include coffee grounds, fresh manure, food scraps, spoiled produce, young weeds, and beer mash. Sometimes we refer to our nitrogen sources as the greens, though they are not always that color. Another way I like to think of nitrogen sources, they tend to be things that were recently fresh. 3. roughly 20 wheelbarrows, of organic material high in carbon. Examples include cardboard, hay, leaves, paper, napkins, sawdust, straw, and wood chips. We often call our carbon sources the browns, because they often are brown. 4. Air and water. How to gather materials. It takes a lot of raw material to create even a little compost. A compost pile will shrink from when you first stack it. The nitrogen sources tend to be only about 20% solid or less. To access the organic materials listed earlier, you'll need to ask members of your community for donations of waste. These partners can include coffee shops for coffee grounds and filters, and chaff if they roast their own beans, local breweries, spent grain, food banks or food pantries, spoiled produce, grocery stores, produce scraps and cardboard, separated, restaurants, produce scraps, local farmers, manure, old hay and straw, and city agencies, leaves, wood chips, and grass clippings. Make it easier for businesses to collect this waste by offering 25-gallon storage bins devoted to your project. Provide each business with a pickup time. Make sure to be there, and give credit to those who donate at your event. Businesses are often looking for ways to improve their environmental profile, and you might be surprised by how eager people will be to participate. Building your pile. You'll want to build your pile by layering carbon and nitrogen in roughly equal amounts. I often say that a compost pile is about 75% carbon-heavy material and 25% nitrogen-heavy material. This is deceptive, though, because the nitrogen material is full of water and breaks down so much. So, when you're building your compost pile, think of your carbon/nitrogen materials ratio as 1:1. The bottom level of your pile should be about a foot thick and full of carbon material. This layer allows for proper aeration at the bottom. Air is important for the pile's proper decomposition. Without air, the pile will also be a lot smellier. Ideally, the bottom layer will have a lot of straw. After this first layer of carbon is down, put in a layer of nitrogen-heavy material about a foot deep. Then put in a similar layer of carbon material. Then nitrogen. Then carbon. Then nitrogen. When you get to the top of the pile, make sure that your last layer is carbon. This will help contain the smells. While you're stacking, invite young people to jump up and down on the pile periodically to tamp it down. After you're done stacking, grab a hose and add water to the pile. The water helps support microbes that will digest it all. You'll want the compost material to be about as moist as a wrung-out sponge. If it is too wet, it can be hard for enough air to get in. Go do something else for 9 months. Keep yourself busy for 9 months with other things. The pile may finish quicker in a warm climate and slower in a cold climate. You can check the pile periodically by digging your hands into it and feeling how hot it is. Ideally, the middle of your pile will get as warm as 150 to 160 degrees. If the pile is too dry and not breaking down fast enough, you can add some more water. You can tell when the pile is done when it cools down to about 80 to 90 degrees. Congratulations! When finished, I put handfuls of red wiggler worms in the compost pile to increase the soil's fertility. When your pile begins to cool down, worms will often find their way in on their own, provided there are some nearby. In our greenhouses, we put our finished compost in pots that are 12 inches deep. We top off this compost with a 3/4-inch layer of vermicompost, worm castings, for extra fertility. Then we seed our pots with things like lettuces and mustard greens, arugula, and daikon radishes. Some people sift their compost when it's done with a 1/4-inch screen. I tend to like my compost chunky, with lots of wood chips. These chips are useful because during the process of composting, they become rich with fungi. Soil that is fungal has an easier time of transferring nutrients into the root systems of plants. You'll get better at composting the more you do it. The naturalist John Muir once spoke of how meddling with the environment can have unintended consequences, and how the different parts of nature are bound fast by a thousand invisible cords. When you compost, you are helping to strengthen the cords of nature. Part 3. The Revolution. Overnight Success. In 1890, the U.S. Census Bureau ranked professions that had the highest rate of suicide. Tailors, accountants, bookkeepers, clerks, and copyists suffered the most. At the bottom of the list was a career least likely to lead to self-harm. Farming. During the farm crisis of the 1980s, the suicide rate for American farmers rose in several states to double the national average. In an effort to combat mental health problems among farmers, Congress authorized the creation of a Farm and Ranch Stress Assistance Network in 2007. Several recent studies have attempted to understand why many farmers are struggling emotionally. Some farmers who are asked about the high rates of suicide speak of a sense of loss, the loss of community, the loss of income, and not least, the loss of independence. Many rural farmers say that they are increasingly paid less for more work, and they owe more today for their seeds, fertilizers, equipment, and pesticides. They work one or two jobs outside of their farm in order to stay on their land. They feel ashamed that they cannot be self-sufficient in the way they believe their ancestors were. Instead of growing many crops, they plant hundreds of acres of corn or soybeans. They spread their fields with fertilizer and work off the farm while the corn grows. At the end of the season, the crop is harvested with a large combine. This is an agriculture controlled by large machines. The land and the people on it are only units of production. The farmer may be compelled to grow on a scale that is uncomfortably large to him. He may borrow money for equipment he can't afford, and he may never meet the people or the industrial animals who eat what he produces. The economist E. F. Schumacher wrote a book a quarter century ago called Small is Beautiful, Economics as If People Mattered, in which he argued that the belief that bigger is better was not always true when you consider the emotional health of human beings. Schumacher argued that people need jobs where they have a chance to enjoy themselves while working, instead of working solely for pay and hoping, usually forlornly, for enjoyment solely during their leisure time. He argued for new agricultural methods that build up soil fertility and produce health, beauty, and permanence. Instead of setting prices for their food in their own communities, farmers are now caught in a system where national or international markets set the prices. For every 100 pounds of milk a farmer produces, it typically costs him around $18. Yet in the last decade, global competition has sometimes dropped the market price of milk to less than $12 per 100 pounds. For the farmer already in debt, who rises early and works late, the mental weight of a drop in prices can be too much to bear. In upstate New York in early 2010, one dairy farmer shot 51 of his cows before turning his gun on himself. When the farmer's friends buried the cows outside of his barn, none of the men agreed to speak to an Associated Press reporter about the reasons behind their friend's death. One man explained simply that these are hard times to be a farmer. When the price of milk dropped precipitously in February of 2009, a string of suicides among dairy farmers in Vermont and Maine made local headlines. Male farmers take their own lives at several times the rate of female farmers, perhaps because they feel they must live up to an old American ideal of rugged independence and individualism. Farmers who take their own lives have also been found to be less likely to leave a suicide note than others. It is as if these men don't feel entitled to give voice to their feelings, even in death. If we are to make farming a profession that young people want to enter, we need to create new models for growing and distributing food that are emotionally satisfying. We have to be guided by the principle that small is beautiful. I feel fortunate that I have found a way to grow food on a human scale, and I have secured a certain kind of independence. I seed with my own hands. I participate in the harvest. I have always loved the process of trial and error in organic agriculture and the way the work engages both my body and mind. At its best, farming can provide a lifelong education that engages you physically, intellectually, and spiritually. It takes intelligence, instinct, and lived experience to be able to predict when your crops are about to go south before they do, to know when they have been planted in the wrong spot or overwatered, and how to compensate for these problems before it is too late. I once spoke to an 80-year-old farmer who told me, "I'm just learning how to grow food." I feel this way. I think if we are going to foster a revolution in the methods of American agriculture, we must pioneer ways to make small-scale farming economically viable. We need to create farms that can grow multiple crops in an intensive way, even on small plots of land. Nearly a decade ago, our work at Growing Power began to focus on ways to make this happen. During my early history at my roadside stand, my commercial vegetable production there had mostly been restricted to seed starts of lettuce and carrots and collards. Other gardeners could buy these seedlings and transplant them to their own gardens. Each spring, I also grew bedding plants in my greenhouses, perennials such as carnations, petunias, and marigolds. We raised a couple hundred tilapia in our living system fish barrels in our second greenhouse. We kept a demonstration garden for students. The produce that we sold in the store, though, had come almost entirely from my partners in the Rainbow Farmers Co-op and from my acreage in Oak Creek. Over a period of several years, this changed. My staff and I learned how to adapt the intensive organic growing practices from my own fields to our small urban plot on Silver Spring Drive. I became an urban farmer. Growing food on 2 acres appealed to me at first as a challenge. I wondered how much I could produce in 5 greenhouses and in my back lot. In time, I came to see the potential benefits of agriculture in small urban spaces. The Milwaukee winters are bitter. The average low temperature in January is 13 degrees. If people in the city were to have local food year-round, we needed to find ways to grow intensively, even in the bitterest parts of winter. I also saw the opportunity that inner-city farms and high-yield backyard gardens had to remedy problems that are damaging our environment, morale, and health. In the last 3 decades, more than 40 million acres of rural land in the United States have been developed, an area roughly the size of New Jersey and Illinois combined. This process of urbanization is likely only to increase in the future. Cities will continue to expand, and their populations will increase. I have spent enough time in the countryside and in cities to see that their fates are linked. When prices rise for wheat, corn, and oil, for instance, the urban poor are often unable to afford the higher food costs. A future urban population that depends entirely on distant rural farms will also place even greater demands on our infrastructure, roads, bridges, and airplanes. We can't expect our food of the future to be produced only by traditional farming families in rural areas. These families have increasingly been pushed off their land, and the quality of the soil has been degraded. If we can figure out ways for more people to control the growth, marketing, and distribution of food on a local and regional level, and even to grow some food within cities, I believe we can play a part in remedying some of the problems that are troubling us as a country right now. The absence of jobs, the problems of waste, the crisis of rising energy costs, and the lack of access among low-income communities and people of color to healthy, affordable food. We need to create farmers who can produce $200,000 intensively on a single urban acre, as well as those who can grow $500 on an acre in the countryside. My composting operation demonstrated that an urban agriculture facility like ours could transform a city's waste stream, diverting discarded vegetables and paper and cardboard from landfills and turning it into healthy soil. From my early start with the Syndic's Grocery Store and Altera Coffee, I developed more than a dozen other compost partners over time. I was picking up waste from a large Milwaukee wholesaler called Maglio's Stone Creek Coffee and a Piggly Wiggly grocery store. A large Milwaukee beer producer called Lakefront Brewery started giving me truckloads of the moist, spent grains left over from the brewing process. I was saving each of these businesses money that they had previously paid to hauling companies. I was making money from this waste by converting it into soil and fresh food. A broad vision was taking shape in my head of a new urban ecology, where a city's waste could connect to its food-producing streams, and where small facilities like my own could be not only food stands, but also food producers. This dream was not fully formed. It appealed to me as a puzzle would. I set about trying to build it in my greenhouses and back lot, piece by piece. At my farm in Oak Creek, I had long ago adopted intensive growing techniques I learned from my father and from Belgian backyard farmers. My level of productivity was possible only through the use of compost and my seeding technique. For small farmers, the two main ways to seed a field are precision seeding or broadcast seeding. Precision seeding requires a machine that puts seeds one by one in the ground. I always broadcast seeded by hand, scattering the seeds onto the ground. Through years of experience, I had come to know precisely how much seed I could use for each crop in the space I was provided. I never let anyone else do the seeding for me, because I didn't trust that they could do it right. I could only seed my vegetables so closely together in Oak Creek because of the quality of my compost. Almost all of the land in the United States has been depleted of its natural health. Soil scientists say that it can take as many as 1,000 years to develop an inch of nutrient-rich topsoil. Virgin topsoil provides an array of vitamins and minerals that are necessary for both healthy plants and healthy people: calcium, nitrogen, magnesium, and potassium. For short-term gain over the last 2 centuries, we have stripped the land of its ability to provide these nutrients. When we harm the soil finds ways to harm us. The Dust Bowl of the 1930s was created in part by farmers who had overplowed the topsoil of the Great Plains. The land was tilled too deeply and abused for decades by planting the same crop over and over again. The soil became vulnerable to wind and dust storms. In the last several decades, the industrial agriculture system has depended heavily on chemical fertilizers that are high in nitrates, which farmers feel are necessary to produce high yields year after year. Plants use these fertilizers inefficiently, and when it rains, the fertilizer ends up running off into our drinking water. More than a quarter of wells in the United States now contain levels of nitrates that are considered higher than the acceptable standard. Excess human consumption of nitrates has been linked to gastric and bladder cancers. High levels in drinking water have also been connected to a condition called blue baby syndrome. The nitrates begin a chain of biological reactions in infants that deprive the child's organs and tissues of oxygen. This syndrome is most common in rural agricultural areas where chemical fertilizers are widely used. The gradual depletion of the land's natural health has also meant that most of our crops are now less nutritious than they were even 50 years ago. The amounts of protein, iron, calcium, phosphorus, and vitamin C have all declined noticeably in all harvested fruits and vegetables in the United States from 1950 to 1999. Riboflavin, a B vitamin that helps the body convert food into energy and that is necessary for healthy skin, eyes, hair, and liver, declined overall in fresh foods during that time period by nearly 40%. I wanted to farm in a way that healed that damage. With my worm castings and compost at Silver Spring Drive, I believed that I could meet one of the biggest challenges of growing food in an urban environment: the problem of the land's fertility. I knew that healthy food starts with healthy soil. As I began to think about bringing my organic techniques inside, I recognized that my greenhouses offered not just horizontal space, but also vertical space. If you measured my growing capacity simply by the footprint on the ground, the greenhouses covered about 1/2 acre. Yet at their highest point, the greenhouses were as tall as 15 feet. If I maximized the use of this space and the available light, I thought I could perhaps triple or quadruple the amount of food I could grow there. In 2003, I invited a gentleman to my facility who had experience growing sunflower sprouts and pea shoots. At one of our workshops, he provided a lesson on his techniques. He planted seeds in bedding trays that were only a few inches deep, using a thin layer of potting soil and peat moss. The peat moss increased the soil's capacity to hold water. With this technique, he was able to go from seeding to harvest in little more than a week. He shaved the sprouts a couple of inches from the root when harvesting them, and the pea shoots would soon grow back again. He could harvest a tray two or three times before the soil was depleted. I saw a future in sprouts. Sunflower sprouts are high in vitamin D, which helps with the absorption of calcium and is thought to help the immune system. People often obtain vitamin D through exposure to the sun. In the long Milwaukee winters, it can be hard for people to get the amount they need. Sunflower sprouts are also very high in protein, calcium, and not least, chlorophyll, which some people have credited with everything from relieving inflammation to deodorizing the body. The sprouts were also well-suited as a cash crop for my greenhouses. They could be cultivated year-round, harvested frequently, and grown intensively. If we were to figure out how to grow food profitably in the city, we would need to maximize the amount of income generated per square foot. Growing in urban spaces often requires more money than growing on land in the countryside. There are higher energy costs, higher costs for land, and a farmer cannot take advantage of traditional economies of scale. I began experimenting with my own method of growing sprouts. Instead of potting soil with peat moss, I helped create a special soil mix using our worm castings. It takes centuries to create peat moss, and many of the bogs where it has been mined commercially are now depleted. As a replacement, we bought blocks of coir, coconut fiber, which is a natural byproduct of coconut farming. Our soil mix for sprouts was one part worm castings to one part coir. With our fertile soil, I could broadcast our sunflower and pea seeds in 10-by-20-inch trays. I was soon getting better results than the gentleman who introduced us to sprouts. The taste of the sprouts was full-bodied and vivid. With the idea of increasing the amount of sprouts we could grow in small spaces, my staff, volunteers, and I built shelves in the first greenhouse that allowed us to stack three rows of trays vertically. I quickly determined that if I had enough demand, I could make roughly $50 per square foot from my sprout trays every year before expenses. If I could sell an acre of sprouts, nearly 44,000 square feet, that could potentially be a significant source of income. I began searching for markets, and I was able to entice several of the city's best restaurants to be our first customers. One of my other interests was to see if I could get our food into Milwaukee's public schools. School district food managers in the United States have long faced difficult circumstances if they try to incorporate local food into school lunches. These managers are provided a limited budget at the beginning of a year, and they are often under pressure to cut costs. For several decades, they have generally depended on large regional wholesalers and on federal surplus programs for products like milk. Many schools also do not have in-house kitchens. The meals are prepared off-site, making it harder for schools to incorporate foods that are highly perishable. In the mid-1990s, potatoes were the only vegetable in the top 10 food categories purchased by school food administrators. They were served mostly in the form of French fries. Milk, pizza, ground beef, cheese, chicken nuggets, and hot dog rolls all made the top 10 list. Advocates for children's health and for local farmers recognized that if there were ways to connect farmers to schools in the communities they served, it could potentially be a good thing for young people who were suffering the health effects of bad food, and a good thing for small farmers who were struggling for their livelihoods. Several farm-to-school initiatives began around the country, including in nearby Madison in 2002. In 2005, the city of Milwaukee contracted with the large food distributor, Sysco, to provide most of the produce for its breakfast and lunch program. Soon afterward, I struck up conversations with several people in the Milwaukee Public Schools system to try to persuade them that purchasing our sprouts would be good for the health of the city's children. Sysco soon approached me, saying that the Milwaukee school system was interested in our products, and I negotiated a fair price with them. Within a year, Our sprouts were in 24 schools in the city of Milwaukee. I have been told the children eat them because they taste like real food. Most of their prior experiences with vegetables in school have been of the canned and soggy variety. After we had refined our system for growing sprouts, I looked for other ways to use the vertical space in our greenhouses. We began planting salad greens in hanging pots that we filled with compost, topped with worm castings, and hung from long rods attached to the roofs of our front greenhouses. We were soon producing rainbow chard, beet greens, spinach, tat soy, a spicy Asian green with curled leaves, kale, dandelion greens, arugula, and several varieties of lettuces. As with the sprouts, we shaved the leaves when they were still tender, allowing for future harvests, and the taste was pungent and delicious. These greens were easy to market to upscale restaurants and cooperatives in the city who would tout their relationship with an urban farm. We also sold the greens in our own retail store and distributed them as part of our market baskets. I took pride as I walked through my greenhouses and saw a new vertical farm taking shape, with pots hanging on several levels. I had been raising fish indoors in barrels since the late 1990s, and I began to wonder if it were possible to scale these systems up. Our dozen sets of three-barrel living systems allowed us only to raise a couple hundred tilapia at a time. Though the barrels always interested kids who visited my facility, we weren't growing enough fish to generate any kind of consistent revenue. I saw a local market. Milwaukee was famous for its Friday night fish fry, a tradition that is said to have started decades ago among Catholics who were supposed to refrain from eating meat on Fridays. Families turned to fish as an alternative to red meat. Today, nearly every self-respecting restaurant in the city offers fried fish on Fridays. I believed that I could do quite well by marketing tilapia locally because I could save the buyer transportation costs. Most tilapia consumed in Milwaukee were being imported from China or Central and South America. At Growing Power, we undertook a few early experiments before we got the fish systems right. I was in Kmart one August day in 2003, for instance, and I saw that they had an end-of-summer sale on a 5,000-gallon above-ground swimming pool. It cost $199. I decided to purchase the pool and create a pond in my fourth greenhouse. I adapted the basic principles that we had used in the barrel systems. I connected some PVC pipe to the pool, and we pumped the water out to a filtering tank before recirculating it back into the pool again. I put several hundred tilapia in the pool, and within a few weeks I saw that the new system worked. But I felt that the pump and tank were consuming too much energy. The thing I had admired the most about our old three-barrel living systems was how they replicated the processes of the natural world. Fish excrete ammonia after they eat, and in an enclosed space, this can soon become toxic to them. The fish can also starve for oxygen if the water is not aerated. Commercial fisheries often deal with these problems in a way that consumes lots of energy, employing mechanical aerators, filtration systems, and giant recirculating pumps. Our living systems, on the other hand, used compost, snails, and vegetable matter to clean up the ammonia before the water returned to the fish tank. The only electrical part of the operation was a small $15 pump. Each system cost about $70 to build and about $50 a year to maintain. I wanted to try to keep the spirit and the low costs of these natural systems while increasing their scale. I knew that the gentleman who had introduced our living systems to us, Jonathan Woods, had been experimenting for many years with a technique called aquaponics. This was the practice of growing fish and fresh vegetables for the market in the same linked system. In the mid-1980s, horticulturalists at North Carolina State University had pioneered this technique by taking water from a tank containing tilapia and pumping it up into a large sand bed that was planted with bush beans, tomatoes, and cucumbers. The fish's wastewater was filtered by the sand and the plant's roots. Beneficial bacteria in the sand converted the ammonia into nitrogen, which the plant's root systems could use as fertilizer. The planting bed was tilted very slightly so that gravity drained the wastewater slowly from one end to the other until it spilled back into the fish tank again. The researchers were ultimately able to harvest more than 500 pounds of fresh vegetables from their sand bed. The fish also did well. Of the 813 fish the researchers initially put in the system, about 800 survived and grew to market size. I particularly like the idea of an aquaponic system in an urban setting because of its efficient use of space. It provided several marketable products at once. The system also was consistent with the spirit of my compost operation. It was a closed loop where the fish's waste was converted into life and energy, and the water was recycled. My staff and volunteers and I experimented with a few small-scale prototypes before I felt confident to build a larger aquaponic system. One of our first preliminary models used a 250-gallon tank. At one end of the tank, we built two gutters that sloped gently down toward a separate holding tank of the same size. We placed pots of tomatoes and herbs in those gutters. When we turned the system on, overflowing water from the fish tank came slowly down the gutters and was absorbed into the plant's root systems. From the holding tank, the filtered water was then pumped back into the fish tank. The plants grew well, and the fish that we tested in the system did just fine. On an early winter day in 2004, I was walking through the second greenhouse from the road when I allowed myself to dream bigger. At the time, I was still growing a large number of bedding plants there. Our greenhouses were 100 feet long, and I thought about the potential of having a narrow tank that extended almost that entire length of one of them. I wanted to grow food in raised beds above the tank. Instead of raising a few hundred fish at a time, I thought we could raise several thousand. I also thought that digging down into the ground would be an effective use of available space. The earth would provide some insulation to keep the water warm. We could be growing vegetables in the air and fish in the ground. A few months earlier, I had hired Rick Muller, a soft-spoken and kind man who had recently lost his lease on his Waukesha aquarium shop in the wake of the recession in the early 2000s. Rick had been keeping aquariums since he was 10 years old, and he had a special love for aquatic plants. I took Rick into our second greenhouse, and I stuck a spade in the ground there. What do you think about us digging out a raceway? 3 feet down, the entire length of this greenhouse, to grow tilapia, I said. Rick had questions about how we would filter all of the water. We soon came up with a design that adapted the techniques of the North Carolina State researchers. With the help of 75 volunteers, we dug a long trough without any power equipment. The soil was harder than we had thought, and this process took 3 months. We lined the walls of this giant raceway with wood and covered it with plastic pond liner. Directly over top of the raceway, on wooden platforms, we built two long planting beds. These beds were constructed to mimic the ecosystem of a small river or stream. Water from the fish system was pumped up to one end of the top bed, which we had also covered with pond liner, filled with tiny pebbles, and then topped with potted tomato and strawberry plants. The wastewater flowed gently down the first bed, which was slanted very slightly. The plants' root systems, which were exposed by holes in the bottom of their plastic pots, helped filter the ammonia. Then the water spilled onto the second bed, which was planted with watercress and slanted slightly in the other direction. By the time that the water spilled back into the fish tank, it had traveled nearly 200 feet and passed through the roots and soil of several hundred plants. When we got the pumps working and the plants in place, Rick ordered 4,000 tilapia fingerlings. They arrived from New Mexico in four large trash bags that were filled with a little bit of water. Volunteers and staff stood around as we introduced the fish to the system. We lost only 24 fish in the first couple of weeks, which was less than 1% of the total. After that, the fish were beautiful, and they did great, Rick remembers. We were proud not only that our new aquaponics system worked, but about how inexpensive it was to build. We estimated that a commercial system to raise 4,000 tilapia would cost $50,000 or more. We constructed our entire system, which consisted only of wood, pond liner, and a single pump, for $2,000. It had maintenance costs that were not insignificant. We had to feed the fish for 9 months, and we had to pay the energy costs for the pump and for the system's use of an existing water heater, tilapia-like water temperatures of about 75 degrees. Once the fish reached market size, though, we could sell them for